You want to do a podcast only?
Yeah.
What do we want to do?
I well, okay.
Or is this it?
No. This is it. You're still running this, right?
Right. Yep.
Okay. You said something, and I wanna I didn't want to interrupt you. I didn't want to get into like a science talk.
Okay.
But I'm fascinated because I'm personally fascinated by this idea of group selection. And I just want to run this by you and have you react to it. Because to me, when I first started, when I read this and read it again and again and again, it blew my mind over and over. So we understand in a basic sense, evolution. There's adaptation, there's stresses in the environment. As the environment changes, as stress changes, those best adapted to that stress are able to kind of overcome and adapt and shed their genes onto the next generation. And those are the ones that propagate. Those are the ones that survive. So we are, in a sense, derivations of like the winning strategies of the past, and the losing strategies have died off. You get to a certain point in human evolution, and you can see this in other species, but in humans, it's very clear. If your inner reptilian brain is antisocial, where you are not altruistic, you don't work well with others, you're a different person than if your inner reptilian brain is very altruistic. You have empathy towards other people. You care about other people. You are willing to put other people ahead of yourself. Even if it's beyond your own genes, like my own kids, I feel that way. And we automatically do, because that reptilian part of our brain, but you develop it for other people that are of your ilk, but not necessarily of your, and you do that for a bunch of reasons. We don't have to get into what those reasons are. If you look at a society of one or the other, what you find is that the society of the altruistic people are going to perform better than the selfish people, right? Here's the crazy thing. What it means over time, in like iterations of humans, the winning strategy is to be altruistic. The winning strategy is to work together in a community. The winning strategy is also to be fearful of the other tribe, right? A lot of what we have as expressions of altruism and fear, all these things, they're reptilian parts of our brain.
Yeah,
we've said we like to look and say, oh, you are smart and enlightened because you are altruistic, and you are less enlightened and more of a heathen because you're selfish. When the reality is that, you know, to quote Sirius Black in Harry Potter, we both have good and bad within us. And it's interesting because it is that evolutionary cycle that has, in a sense, made us altruistic in a way that I think we can all somewhat innately access. And small towns, what I find endearing about small towns is that the best of them, the ones that are doing the best today, when you go there and live amongst them and participate in their town with them, it just activates that reptilian part of your brain that's altruistic. It does over and over and over, day to day, and all these little things. It's a muscle. Right?
Yeah.
That's there.
And it gets you to do things you wouldn't normally do.
Almost involuntarily. Like I find myself wanting to do things that I otherwise wouldn't want to do. And that is a human adaptation to group evolution being superior to like individual isolated evolution.
Yeah. What things?
I want to help you. I see you're in need. I want to help you. Now, I don't want to, you know, you can show me a picture of like, you know, homeless people in the you know, city in southern Minnesota, and I may at church be kind of shamed into pitching $10 into a pot to send to them. But if I see you suffering with cancer, like, yeah, I'm going to make you a meal. Like I'm going to come over and help you clean your house. I'm going to help you do this. When we have like personal connections with people, those altruistic things become free flowing for a lot. I'm not saying everybody is like this all the time, but the pathway to doing it is very free flowing. It's not something you have to work hard at.
I'm reminded. So my dad and my stepmom moved to Chisago County a few years back, near Lindstrom, very conservative area. And just for some perspective, they moved to a lake where there's a little community of people who live on this side of a little lake out in Chisago County. And they have a social, like a social group that meets every particular night of the week. Every week, the usually the men folk of these houses all get together at one of their garages and they sit and chat and whatever. And my father, who, keep in mind, was the guy who once told me he never wanted to live anywhere. He couldn't shoot something off his back porch.
Right.
This is the dad who, when I spent 6 months volunteering for the DFL in 1996, the first ever experience with politics I ever had, went to the ballot box and voted straight ticket Republican. My dad is the liberal in this group now.
Yeah.
They're very conservative people. But when I have gone there and met them, because he does a party and all gatherings are neighbors included, you know, and they are ridiculous for how they help each other. Nothing is off limits. Your furnace is broken? I'll go fix your furnace.
I'm coming over. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, there's a gentleman who's disabled and he doesn't have to want or worry. You know, everybody takes care of each other. Mm-hmm. It's gorgeous, beautiful. When the kids were younger, we went over there and then you want tractor rides? The guy with the tractor comes over, the kids are in the tractor. Everybody's having a great time. Every kid is happy and, you know, it's beautiful.
Right.
It's beautiful. But then when the talk turns to politics, it becomes like, for me, the liberal, oh my goodness, you just hate people. You know, what is the deal? But then you're confronted with the reality that these are not bad people. These are exceptionally good people, right. You know? And it's this, I think that comes back to what you were talking about, though, that reptilian part of the brain, like, you know, I'm not one to put my money into a pot to give to random people who need help, supposedly. On the other hand, if my neighbor is in need, I'll do anything for them.
Let me take it in, I think, even a more disturbing way, because I don't know how to deal with this. Like, I don't know the answer to this question. I grew up with a couple of notable people in my life who were gay. And they were, it was not something that was like broadly discussed and talked about, either in a like accepting way or a shaming way. It just kind of was, it is. We had one gentleman who was a family friend would come around, we'd sit at the table. He would bring his, you know, I don't know what you would have called at the time. Today it would be husband, but back then it wasn't. It was his companion would come. And we were, you know, pull out the cookies and, you know, let's have coffee. And it was very like everybody's friendly. And there was no like, you know, effort to like shame or vilify or what have you. Now, when we ever had conversations about, you know, different lifestyles than what we had, there was a lot of judgment. You know, I mean, growing up, we used to call people derogatory words for being a homosexual. That was like our way of, you know, and if my
ninth grade yearbook is a horror show of,
yeah, no,
of
totally.
That kind of thing.
If you like, you know, were playing football and hurt your ankle, you were called, you know, some derivation of a homosexual, you know, that's what you were. And that was very like free flowing talk. It was cruel and it was mean. But it was also like our culture. It was how we kind of dealt with this. Were there kids who were probably gay who participated in that on the receiving or giving end? Probably. Right. Or kids who went on to like discern that they were not heterosexual. Yeah. So I look at this and I say, okay, I clearly see how small towns can be, and understand the guy who was gay, he went to church, he dressed like us, he talked like us. So the differences were subtle, but they were also self-evident. I mean, we all knew this. A society can treat this person generally with care and compassion, but yet also kind of have this certain level of conformity. I can guarantee that if this family friend had shown up, as the personification of a gay lifestyle, which take it in your mind wherever you want.
Yeah,
yes, take it in your mind wherever you want with that. That person would have been less accepted in our community. And this is the line that I don't quite get, because if we switch over to like race, you know, we're having this really dysfunctional conversation nationally about racism. I think it's dysfunctional because I don't think it's moving us to a place that's helpful. Helpful in it breaks down those barriers is how I would define helpful. I can tell you that if someone who is black moves to Brainerd and they are professional, they wear a tie, they go to the meetings, they speak like Norwegian Minnesotans, mm-hmm. that person is going to have a far easier path to acceptance than the blue collar, you know, black who moves to town, who it does not have those same kind of front row characteristics. Does that make us racist? Does that make us less accepting?
I'll pull an example.
I struggle with this because there's this is the bad side of the together in a community part that we need to have.
I think
how do you have one without the other?
Yeah, I think people are afraid of things that might change the community.
Yes.
And if that's so, if a group of people who are identifiably of another race, culture, or religion move into community, there's this fear that the community will change. I'll give you another example, kind of related to what you just said. I'm doing historical research.
Can I ask this question though?
Yes, yes.
And say your example, but I want it in the context of if we both agree that the community part of it is important. Mm-hmm. So in other words, you being socially bonded to me and us being this joint project of doing the community, which has a certain conformity aspect to it. Mm-hmm. How do you then integrate others, not of that, who are very different maybe, mm-hmm. into that? That's the thing that I struggle with.
Well, and it kind of relates to the example. Like, so I'm researching Iron Range history, and it was a cultural collision of not necessarily black and white, but a lot of the immigrant groups that were moving to the range in the early 1900s were perceived by the people in town, the lawyers and the city fathers, using the old term, were perceived as being not white, you know, maybe not black, but certainly not white. And so there was a racial dynamic. There was language dynamic and religion, because a lot of the immigrants were Catholic and the ruling class was mostly Protestant, Lutheran. And so all of that kind of collided all at once, and a lot of that came out just the way you describe. I was going to use the example of a gentleman who for many years was the only, well, he and his wife were the only Chinese family in the city of Hibbing in the teens, 20s through the 1950s. They lived most of his life there, and, you know, he grew up in China and became an engineer and worked in the mines. He was a mining engineer. He dressed like the other mining engineers. He spoke English, taught his children to, you know, think of themselves as Americans, and they were not they had Chinese heritage, but they were Americans first. And in fact, even he never became a citizen. He only ever had a work visa. And even though he couldn't vote, he became the chair of the local Republican Party for many years. And just because he believed that that's what the true Americans would be at the time, you know,
right.
And he was with his fellow mining engineers, which were tended to be a conservative lot anyway. So he adopted exactly what, you know, frankly, the other conservatives would have wanted any person from another place to do, which is to become
right.
exactly like us to the degree possible. And whether there was ever any, his son, I didn't talk to his son, I talked to his grandson, who explained, you know, he never complained about anything in Hibbing. He loved Hibbing, and he loved everything about the people, and they were always kind to him. I don't know if that necessarily was always true, you know, because another guy told me a story of, you know, yeah, everyone remembered him because the scram miners would take advantage of him when he wasn't looking. They would mine where they shouldn't mine, and they didn't treat him very well, actually.
Right.
You know, so I get that part of the story too. But I think if you become what the community wants you to be, if you become what a son or daughter of your town or place should be, you are, I always, like when I write about range history as a younger person, less young than when I started, but as a younger person, my wife and I always joke, like I have groupies. They're all men in their 70s. And the reason I've kind of just determined is that my writing and talking about this stuff is kind of a validation of a life lived. I think that's what these small town communities want, is a validation. And so, like you, the story you mentioned, being gay is fine as long as you allow us to be the community we think we are.
And so how do you bring in? Mm-hmm. And I think this is the part that I struggle with today, because progressivism in general is a lot about liberating us from constraints. Mm-hmm. You've had to live a lie. You can't be the person you want to be. You're not as accepting as, you know, other cultures are of minorities, or, you know, women want to rise up in the workplace.
Yep. And equal opportunity is the thing. Yeah.
So how do you balance a culture that has those values, which I'm not even arguing are necessarily bad values, but they're in conflict with some of these other values of, you know, you do really well in a small town when you act like us, which is true, which is very true.
But
go ahead.
This is making me confused too. So I don't know where this is going as I speak this. So you have to forgive me. But I'm thinking of the people you were talking about that mm-hmm. you knew as you were growing up. Mm-hmm. Did you hear about... I mean, what was their experience like, or the man of Chinese mm-hmm. descent? We don't know what his actual experience was like. He was looking
what he told his grandson.
And so that couple, were they like another couple that would come over to your house? Did you hear about their daily life?
Uh-huh.
Did you hear, you know?
Yes. Now let me kind of impose a little bit on that, because I think that, you know, for all intents and purposes, we treated them very much like we would have another couple.
Right.
They played cards with my parents. They did, you know, stayed late sometimes. They drank a little bit, mm-hmm. you know, they'd have coffee after church. So in a sense, they were treated very much the same. I think, though, that had they been more open and in your face about their sexuality, you know, had they been like, we're having a gay marriage, or we're going to kiss in front of you, or hold hands, or be like openly affectionate towards each other, which were things that like my parents could have done.
Yeah. Yeah. That's
because they're small town conservative. They probably wouldn't have.
Right.
But there were other people who did. I think that they probably would have been treated differently. I'll also try to walk a mile in their shoes. I am sure that there were times in their lives in a small town where they were called names, not given certain opportunities because of who they were or what their orientation was. I'm sure that they felt a degree of how big it was, but I'm sure they felt a degree of persecution, or like, I can't be fully myself. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm struggling with, because I can tell you as Chuck Marone, there are times in my small town where I definitely feel like I can't be fully myself. That is a trade-off of living in a small town. So how much of it is, like, if we have to have this sense of community to make this place work, because we can't be solely transactional the way a big city can be. But a sense of community also breeds a certain level of exclusion mm-hmm. and you know, persecution of the other. How do you meld those things? And I feel like the progressive response is, well, your values are screwed up and they got to go. Like, we got to, you know, destroy the beehive to save the bees. And I think the opposite point of view is, kick those people out. They don't belong. You know, this is our way of life. And what I struggle with is, I don't really know what the mm-hmm. middle path is there.
Yeah. I'm thinking about a week ago, I think, we did an interview, and then I went to an event, speaking of front row people, right? So I went to an event at the Blandon Foundation that was for Transgender Day of Visibility, and probably all the people that went there are fully accepting. And some of the conversations that happened were about what things do people say to you that are offensive, like people in the audience wanted to know. And so that's kind of what you were talking about with your parents could do certain things, but the gay couple couldn't necessarily, and they would put them into a whole different category. For me, I didn't really think about, I know a few transgender people, but what happens a lot is they get asked, like, have you changed your genitalia? Like, people just directly ask them those questions, where I will never in a million years have someone walk up to me and ask me about those private parts of my body. But how do you...
Could you describe them,
so,
please?
So yeah, let's say, you know, 20, 30 years ago, maybe there wouldn't be a public meeting about that. And there's maybe 30, 40 people there. But what is that... You know, who shows up at that? I mean, it's good that we can talk about it more, but it's self-selecting, too, of the people who are going to show up at that kind of conversation. I'm saying I'm confused.
I'm not coming down with any kind of fire here. I think a lot of this, to me, feels like a power dynamic that has existed in small towns. There's always, I think that's how you can reconcile the Iron Range of 100 years ago versus now and how it was, quote-unquote, multicultural then. And had what we would describe as racial and cultural strife, much like we would see today with different races or whatever. It was fundamentally a struggle for power. The in-group, the dominant culture, was afraid of change, and frankly of losing power and the ability to dictate the terms of their community, dictate the fundamental arguments early in Hibbing history were about whether or not the people who worked in the higher levels of the mining company would have direct control of the town or not. And then once that was settled and the people kind of wrested some of that control away from the company, the question was, you know, what about these new immigrants who are coming in by the droves to work in the mines and their language differences and religious differences and everything else? And some of them are coming in with these socialist ideas. What are we going to do to stop them? And there's a reason why the KKK was active and effectively organizing in range towns for a period of about 10 to 15 years in the 1920s into the 30s. It was a response to this. And not like a fringe group. There were city councils that, you know, a majority were elected with the support of the Klan. So, you know, this is part of our history, and it always seems to do with power. And that's what I think the classic example in our contemporary time is the whole debate between the Black Lives Matter and then people who respond by saying All Lives Matter. And then the police response that you often see, these Blue Lives Matter and the flags with the blue stripe on them that you see displayed outside police stations now and in paraphernalia you can purchase at local stores and wear. A lot of this seems like, well, if you just... there's a failure of understanding that the Black Lives Matter movement has to do with a power dynamic, with where an event that happens to a Black person is treated differently than an event that happens to anybody else, but especially a white person or a person of power of any kind. And it's about equalizing that power. That's the fundamental nature of the movement, as I understand it, as it's been explained to me. And then the response that, well, no, hold on here. All lives matter is, in fact, this is what infuriates people, because people who say all lives matter, generally speaking, believe it. You know, for the most part, I think they do.
They're not saying all lives except, you know,
yeah,
black
they're not
people.
Excluding right. black people.
Right.
But they fail to acknowledge
the power dynamic
that black people feel much more acutely.
Well, that
than white
functionally,
people.
White lives do matter more than black lives. Functionally, in a lot of realms of society,
it's handled differently. A white life is treated. We're watching it happen in the Minneapolis right now, when the cop happens to be black and the person getting shot happens to be white, the dynamic around the discussion changes, and it's evident right in front of our eyes.
I struggle with this. It's kind of where you were, and I think what you're getting at too. A lot of this is we're caught in this power dynamic, and because we've nationalized everything, we're not able to work this out here locally. This is being kind of forced upon us.
There's always fresh chum coming in from the national newscast.
Exactly. Yeah. I feel like if you go to one of these precincts that Trump did really well in, what you see is that drug use is really high, isolation is really high, opportunity is really low. Religiosity is high, but religious practice is very low. So the sense of community is gone. Those places to me are the breeding grounds of the worst kind of reactionary, if we want to just go down the litany of things that progressives rail on, homophobia, transphobia, racism, you know, to me, those are the breeding grounds. And it's a function of, to me, the isolation is a big part of it. If you go then to places that tended to vote Republican, Utah being a great example, places that but were not Trump hotbeds, places where you have strong social cohesion, strong sense of community. These places are not hotbeds of like the red hot kind of racism, but there are these pockets of what I think people would call the more systematic or the more, you know, they're not necessarily like, oh, bring, you know, all are welcome, bring in whatever you want.
There's more
be
of an
yourself.
Institutional racism rather than a day-to-day practicing racism.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And my example with the gay couple that my parents were friends with, you know, and there were numerous examples like that throughout my growing up. To me, that is an example of a culture being able to assimilate people who were different because they didn't act all that different. You know, their differences were nominal. I feel like today we're being asked to accept kind of an all or nothing. The transgender thing is a very, I've found that whole conversation deeply unsettling. And not unsettling because I think transgender people are bad or wrong or there's something, you know, like I feel like I have a good sense of the biology of it and the kind of, you know, this is one of God's creatures made in this way. And I'm who am I to judge in a sense that you're defective or wrong or should be cast out from our community? I think that people who identify as transgender should be treated with love and compassion. But there's something different about that. And I'm saying this as a small town conservative, celebrating transgender people. And I don't know where that line is. And I'm not saying like I'm going to protest Blandon Foundation because mm-hmm. they had this event. I realize that there is a nuance between go hide and shame and let's put you on a pedestal and celebrate this. I don't know where that nuance is, but it seems like I'm only being offered those two extremes and I'm not really fully comfortable with either. Maybe that makes me not the most enlightened person, the most progressive person, but I think it makes me a small town person.
Yeah,
and I feel like the choices we're given is either to go into the total isolation, which we can just have a proxy for the Trump voter, or go like full the other way, which I'm also not, you know, given those two choices. What we see is that a lot of small towns go the Trump voter way.
Even though a lot of people, like I have mentioned this, a relative, the quote about why he voted for Trump after having not voted for Republicans most of his life. And he shrugged his shoulders and said, well, what was I supposed to do? You know,
yeah.
The sense that all of that change that we're talking about really is change in understanding of people, you know, people exist, you know, gay people, transgendered people existed prior to this. It's just that they were, you know, relegated to the margins of society, and therefore we never had to deal with that.
This week, as we speak, there's a story that's fascinating about some general from, I can't remember what war, but it was like
It's
like the Civil War or the Revolution or something like that. Yeah.
1800s. Yeah.
And they've discovered
was it the French Revolution?
I don't
or
know, but
yeah.
They discovered that this person was transgender, not like a male, but essentially like lived in this world where that was there.
And there are other stories like that out there. And that's exactly how it was handled at the time. You lived the life of whatever your dominant gender or whatever you could pass for.
Right.
And that's how that was handled, you know, and even going back into Native American history, there's different ways of handling, you know, non-binary gender questions, you know, and culturally different cultures came to different conclusions about why that, you know, how do you handle this? What are these people? What are they, what's their role in our society? And some of them had very distinct defined roles for people of that description. Other ones, you know, struggled with it and oppressed and did some of the things that, you know, we've heard about and experienced in this country. So yeah, I don't have a man, you know, sitting here as a progressive who, you know, maybe we're closer to each other than we are to the extremes of our parties, maybe. But there is a reason why, you know, progressives are tending to go one way and conservatives are tending to go the other way. And I think isolation is where we see these extremes come out.
Well, I was opposed to gay marriage. Mm-hmm. I've changed on that. But a lot of my change on that has been because it is not... A lot of my opposition was, it seemed like in many quarters, the push for gay marriage was an anti-family kind of initiative. We've talked about this before, yeah. How mm-hmm. I think gay marriage kind of flipped and became an issue that could get broad support when it was framed not as an alternative lifestyle, but as basically like people who are gay wanting to adopt the middle class lifestyle that other families
have. To
become
families like anybody else.
Right? It became a pro-marriage thing mm-hmm. as opposed to a way to kind of tear down one more cultural, one more backward cultural institution in the dustbin. And I feel like that particular event, the more that we can frame, if we just want to call it progressive cultural change, in the frame of here's how we become more like you, I feel like it makes it a lot easier. Mm-hmm. The more we frame it as here's a major difference that you're just going to have to live with, the more I think. So I guess I'm arguing that when we look at those Trump voter districts, to me, the salvation of them is to actually become more genuinely conservative, more community focused, have more of the scaffolding of what I think progressives would call repression. But I actually think that that scaffolding creates a mechanism to have these kind of broader conversations that ultimately are more tolerant, more loving, more compassionate. And I that's what I struggle with.
Mm-hmm. I promised this studio to someone
else. Oh, so we got to exit. Yeah.
That was the
hook. He's motioning to me and there's a reflection, so I can't see what the motion is. Okay. But I know something's happening. These are really good points, but yes.
The next thing I was going to say was going to be the most brilliant thing ever, but we just can't say it.
Oh my gosh.
No, and I cut both of you off.
I'm kidding.
No,
of course.
Thank you.
More punditry.
I do hope that it comes across that, you know, the three of us, I always speak for the two of you. We're more confused than we are. Like, I don't have firm, here's the absolute right. Here's the absolute wrong. We're trying to figure this out like everybody else, right?
Yeah.
That's right.
I'm with you.
Okay.